Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with France 24. Discussions of Trump's first 100 days dominated the international press this week. So first press reviews from Europe, then the Middle East and Asia on the effects Trump is having on international security, global economics, and changes in the world order. Then press on the tension between India and Pakistan, with the Indian Navy test-firing missiles and Pakistan saying that it has missiles targeting Indian nuclear weapons. Then an interview with Avril Benoit, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA, on the effect of U.S. cuts to USAID. She points out that the medical and health services have been completely vanished by the many cuts to many organizations in the Third World, calling it a human-made disaster. Doctors Without Borders receives no funding from the United States, depends on donations, and that they are attempting to lessen the dire problems arising from the cuts to many aid providers around the globe. France 24.
The international coverage of Donald Trump, 100 days in office, Emily.
Well, let's start in France and look at L'Echo. They have put words to what many of us are feeling, 100 days that feel like 1,000, a sentiment echoed in Libération as well. 100 jours sans fin, 100 never-ending days. They call his second term an enterprise of massive destruction, both in the United States and abroad. In Switzerland, Le Temps had this front page here with a cartoon by Chapat, illustrating their headline, 100 days of noise and fury. The brave aide in the corner there, reminding the president, easy tiger, you still have quite a few days left to go. The Guardian had an opinion piece today, which says that the united theme of Trump's presidency is ineptitude. It outlines the different chaotic episodes of his second term so far. Quotes the Pete Hegseth disaster, the Harvard debacle, the tariff travesty, the Fed chair fiasco, and the measles mayhem, among others. Worth a read just for the subheadings, if you ask me. And finally, The Economist just has this countdown on their front page beside a rather disheveled bald eagle.
Not just US, not just European, of course, right around the world the papers are full of it, aren't they?
Yes, exactly. Well, let's start in the Middle East with the Saudi news site Arab News. For them, the consequences of Trump's presidency are clear. The America First president is overturning the world order. The Kenyan paper, The Standard, has a similar sentiment today. It says that Trump has shattered the US's role on the world stage, adding that Trump has torn down a world order that the US had spent decades building. In South America, the Argentinian site Clarín here takes a look at Donald Trump's dwindling popularity. It says that Trump celebrated his 100th day by lashing out at the polls and calling them fake news. Finally, in Hong Kong, the South China Morning Post is looking at what it calls a power grab by executive order. It says that the official Washington is struggling to keep up with the legality of some of the president's actions.
Now, tension between India and Pakistan, we brought you a lot on this last week, worsening after that terrorist attack in Kashmir that killed 26 civilians. What do you have on this?
Well, The Guardian brings us the latest updates on this story here. India test fires missiles as tension rises with Pakistan after Kashmir attack. It says India's Navy was demonstrating its ability to carry out long-range precision offences. Meanwhile, a Pakistani minister has said that nuclear weapons are targeted at you being India, of course. The New York Times had this interesting article today. It says that India seems to be building a case for striking Pakistan. The article says that India's Prime Minister Indira Modi has not just been trying to de-escalate. It also appears like he might be building his case. In a speech on Thursday, Modi promised severe punishments and the raising of terror safe havens. The article says that the situation is still very volatile. Both sides are continuing to escalate their discourse, and it's not clear if and when the situation could get out of control.
We can now bring in Avril Benoit, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today. Now, since Donald Trump has come into office, we have seen, of course, the Department of Government Efficiency in action making deep cuts to things like USAID. How has that affected your work at Doctors Without Borders in the U.S.?
Well, around the world, Doctors Without Borders, or as we're known internationally, Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, we're not funded at all by the U.S. government, so we're not directly affected. But we're indirectly affected, and it comes in the form of the cuts to ministries of health, so the bilateral funding that the U.S. government would have offered. It comes in the form of some of the subsidies and grants that were going to local health organizations and international non-governmental humanitarian organizations who have now had to close, have withdrawn from areas of great need. We are seeing this as a human-made disaster that will have dire consequences for people's health around the world. I can give you one example, Sudan. So you've got a war, a conflict that has been going on now for a couple of years, 11 million people displaced. And in parts of Sudan, you have community kitchens that were funded by USAID. As a consequence of them no longer having funding, you have a much higher likelihood of malnutrition. And already we know that in Sudan, the malnutrition rates are absolutely shocking. We have cuts to some of the HIV AIDS support programs through the PEPFAR program. We have cuts to programs that were providing safe drinking water for people in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, where so many are displaced by the violence between the gangs and the police. So around the world, we have instances and examples of places where some of the services, the life-saving services that had been available to people that even we relied on as healthcare providers in partnership with others, those services have been withdrawn. And so it's a much greater burden then on those who remain behind, including the ministries of health, the departments of health, the public health workers who are trying to struggle now without all those partnerships that often made their work possible to save lives. Because we're privately funded by millions of supporters around the world, we're still on the ground. And what we're experiencing is an increase in need, an increase in needs that we feel compelled to respond to with the means that we already have, thanks to the generosity of private donors. But we're deeply concerned about this man-made disaster in terms of the cuts to U.S. government funding, because we can see the impacts in terms of those referral hospitals, the arrangements that we often had with other organizations. Just think of water and sanitation as a basic thing. When you have organizations that were funded by the U.S. government that were providing safe drinking water and perhaps doing interventions for cholera, perhaps oral reach hydration points or early intervention health posts around the communities, when those are gone, somebody who has cholera will have to travel a much further distance to reach perhaps the cholera treatment center that we're running. And so that puts a burden on us then to see what can we do to address the water and sanitation issues and do some of the prevention activities without all the supports of the whole infrastructure that was made possible to other organizations and the ministries of health. So in our case, what we're worried about is a 30% increase in patients in some of our clinics and hospitals. We're worried about increasing pressures on our supplies, which cost all the more in our projections because of the tariff wars that are looming. We have certainly a lot of concerns about the need to intervene in places where others are withdrawing, and that includes places like Sudan. It includes places like Ethiopia, South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo. In DRC, you had the U.S. government was funding 70% of the humanitarian response in the East. So you can imagine that these cuts are devastating. And for those who remain behind, like Doctors Without Borders, it's a burden. It becomes an ethical question. How much more can we do with the means that we still currently have?
Avril Benoit, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders, USAID.
Those press reviews and report were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English and most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The victory of Mark Carney as Prime Minister in Canada came in the face of threats by Trump to Canadian sovereignty, resulting in a more unified nation. An interview with Janelle Dumoulin about the feeling among Canadians and the positive response from European leaders. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney will stay in office after his Liberal Party won Monday's election, but it appears to have fallen short of a parliamentary majority. The result leaves Mr. Carney needing help from his political rivals to pass an agenda aimed at confronting Donald Trump's trade war and his threats to annex Canada.
Mark Carney takes the stage following his election win after a campaign overshadowed by threats from US President Donald Trump.
As I've been warning for months, America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country. Never. But these are not idle threats. President Trump is trying to break us so that America can own us. That will never, ever happen.
Carney previously headed the Bank of Canada and Bank of England. Despite a lack of experience in politics, he won a bid to lead Canada's Liberal Party in early March, replacing outgoing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. After calling snap elections and a few weeks on the campaign trail, he's now won the public vote too. A stunning comeback for the Liberal Party. Back in January, opinion polls showed the Liberals trailing the Conservatives. A head start that turned to dust for Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, following Trump's threats against Canada, addressed by Poilievre in his concession speech.
We will always put Canada first as we stare down tariffs and other irresponsible threats from President Trump. Conservatives will work with the Prime Minister and all parties with the common goal of defending Canada's interests and getting a new trade deal that puts these tariffs behind us while protecting our sovereignty and the Canadian people.
But despite the show of unity, the Conservative opposition says it will hold Carney's government to account.
Well, straight to the Canadian capital, where we can join our correspondent Janelle Dumoulin. Welcome, Janelle. Talk us through the challenges now facing Mr. Carney.
Well, Phil, we were in the room last night where Mark Carney delivered his victory speech to his Liberal supporters, and his remarks really did focus heavily on how his government is going to respond to U.S. policies towards Canada, because that really does remain his number one task. It's dealing with the U.S. as well as with the economic fallout that the U.S. tariff war is going to bring upon Canadians. Canadians also expect him to deal with a host of domestic issues as well. Chief of their concerns is housing affordability. Housing costs here have gotten very high. But you know, Mark Carney has positioned himself as a crisis manager. This is what he campaigned heavily on, and now Canadians are really looking to him to deliver.
Tell us more then about Canada's coming relationship with its belligerent southern neighbor. How does Mark Carney plan to navigate that?
The tone from the two leaders has so far been very combative, as you know, verbal shots are fired from both sides of the border. But the two men have spoken before. They spoke, for example, in a phone call last month, in a call that Trump said was productive. The two leaders also said that they will soon be setting a meeting after these elections in order to discuss the future of the U.S. and Canada's economic and security relationship. But I would like to point out that Trump seems to respect Carney more than he respected Carney's predecessor, Justin Trudeau. To my knowledge, I haven't ever heard Trump refer to Carney as Governor Carney the way he did with Justin Trudeau, calling him Governor Trudeau. But then Mark Carney, when he was talking about that same phone call a few days ago, he said that Trump once again mentioned his desire to make Canada the 51st state. And it all goes to show that what he has been saying about how U.S.-Canada relations are just no longer going to exist in the way that they existed before. That is simply a reality, and Mark Carney is going to have to find a way to preserve as much as he can of that relationship while reducing Canada's reliance on the U.S.
Yeah, so if Mr. Carney is planning a pivot away from this close relationship with the U.S., where else might he look?
So he mentioned this in his speech also last night. He said that there were many ways for Canadians to build prosperity other than the United States. So that tells us that building on the partnerships that Canada has around the world is going to be a key part of his strategy. Worth noting that when he first became prime minister, his first visits were to France and the UK. And he said that Canada was the most European, non-European country that existed. So it's clear that he really wants to make overtures to the Europeans in this way. And there could be opportunities. For example, there is that EU plan to rearm, that 800 billion euro plan. And Carney could be looking at that plan to see if any part of that could perhaps benefit Canadian industry. He has signaled that he wants to work with like-minded democratic countries. Perhaps that indicates to us that he's not really looking for a massive pivot to China, although Canada does trade with China. But we do know that strategic alliances around the world beyond the U.S. are going to be a key part of his policy moving forward.
Okay, thanks for that, Janelle. DW correspondent Janelle Dumoulin in Ottawa.
That report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. Deutsche Welle is also up at most podcast sites. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. Delegates from the United States, Russia, and China fought at a UN disarmament meeting. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute pointed out a nearly 10% increase in global military spending last year. NHK Japan.
Delegates from the United States, Russia, and China have engaged in verbal sparring at a UN nuclear disarmament meeting. The three countries possess more than 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. The delegates traded barbs at a preparatory committee meeting to review the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, also known as the NPT. The U.S. delegate said China is rapidly and opaquely increasing its nuclear arsenal and a threat to global peace and stability. He also criticized Russia for developing what he called novel nuclear weapons. The Russian representative said the West's infringement upon other countries' core interests has triggered serious strategic risks. He said those include the potentially dangerous threat of a direct confrontation between nuclear-armed states. China's delegate pointed the finger at both the U.S. and Russia, saying the two countries possess the largest nuclear arsenals. He said that means they must fulfill their special and primary responsibilities for nuclear disarmament. But all three countries acknowledged the importance of the NPT. The framework recognizes them as nuclear powers together with Britain and France. A Swedish research institute says last year's world military expenditures topped $2.7 trillion. That's up 9% from the year before and the largest single-year increase since 1989. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says that with the conflict in Ukraine in its 30-year, military spending kept rising across Europe, including Russia. It says Russia's spending rose 38% to an estimated $149 billion. Ukraine's climbed 2.9% to $64.7 billion. The Institute says Ukraine shouldered the largest military burden of any country in 2024 as its spending made up 34% of its gross domestic product. NATO is working to reinforce its deterrence against Russia. The Institute says all 32 member countries of the alliance boosted their military spending last year. In Germany, Poland, and Sweden, it surged about 30%. The Institute says the United States was the largest spender at $997 billion. It rose 5.7% and accounted for nearly 40% of the global total. China came second with an estimated $314 billion, up 7%. Japan ranked 10th with its defense spending up 21% to $55.3 billion. That's the largest percent increase for a year by the country since 1952. The Institute says China's military buildup has influenced the policies of its East Asian neighbors, prompting many to hike spending. The Institute also says more than 100 countries around the world raised their military spending in 2024. It warns that governments increasingly prioritizing military security could have significant effects on societies for years to come.
Those reports are from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710. Or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. It's also available at most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com. Or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show in the airwaves. Please help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, they will soon have an even greater need for your support as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. U.S. lawyer Kerry Kennedy, representing 10 Venezuelans deported to El Salvador, was denied access to her clients at the notorious prison there. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor, based in Switzerland, says 94% of those killed by Israel in Gaza are civilians. UN Secretary General Guterres warned that the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is the worst it has ever been. Radio Havana, Cuba.
And a U.S. lawyer representing 10 Venezuelan men deported without due process to El Salvador by the Trump administration says she was denied access to her clients at the notorious mega prison in El Salvador. Kerry Kennedy said from San Salvador that she had hoped to document human rights abuses inside the prison. She said, the President of the United States has done so following the same script that President Bukele has used against his own people, the label of terrorists, gang members, without any shred of evidence and any semblance of due process. Kerry Kennedy is a sister of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the daughter of the assassinated former Attorney General and presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy. An international human rights organization has rejected Israel's claims that its forces are fighting Hamas fighters in Gaza. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor, based in Geneva, announced on Monday that at least 94% of the victims of the regime's fatal attacks are civilians. The monitor said that Israeli occupation forces killed 345 Palestinians and wounded over 700 others in just the past 7 days alone. According to Euromed, more than half of the Palestinians killed in that 1 week were children. 16% of them were women, 8% of them were elderly. Even most of the adult males killed in Israeli attacks were working in civilian jobs or independent professions unrelated to any military or organizational activity. The human rights group stressed that this unprecedented rise in the number of civilian deaths coincides with the continued issuance of false media statements by Netanyahu, who publicly denies targeting civilians. The Human Rights Monitor in Geneva also condemned the international silence on the mass killings of Palestinians by Israel, calling it a moral failure and a serious breach of the legal obligations of states and the international community. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that Gaza's humanitarian crisis is deteriorating to levels beyond imagination. Guterres, in remarks on Tuesday, underscored that Israel had killed more than 2,000 Palestinians since it violated the ceasefire agreement on March the 19th, with no end in sight for the killings in Gaza. Guterres further added that Israeli military offensives in the occupied West Bank, settlement expansion, and forcible displacement, ethnic cleansing, are dramatically altering demographic and geographic realities. The United Nations chief further said that the complete blockade of food, fuel, water, and medicine into Gaza has deprived more than 2 million people of life-saving relief. Guterres said that Gaza must remain an integral part of a future Palestinian state. And the UN chief said that illegal Israeli settler violence continues at alarmingly high rates, and the entire Palestinian communities are facing repeated assaults and destruction, sometimes abetted by Israeli soldiers. The United Nations chief gave his remarks at the quarterly UN Security Council open debate on the Middle East, including on the situation in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and Lebanon. Israeli occupation forces have killed more than 50 Palestinians and wounded 113 others just in the past 24 hours. Palestinian death toll since the start of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in October 2023 has now topped over 52,000, mostly women and children.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website works well at radio8c.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radio8c.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcast, get a global perspective. You will have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm recuperating from spinal injuries, I'm staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.